Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is George Werthner. He's the former Ecological Project Director for the Foundation for Deep Ecology. Currently, he's Executive Director of Public Lands Media. He's an ecologist and wildlands activist. He's published 38 books on environmental issues and natural history, including such environmentally focused books as Welfare Ranching, Wildfire, Thrillcraft, Energy, and most recently, Protecting the Wild. So, first, as always, thank you for your wonderful work in defense of the wild. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you, Derek. Love being on it.
Oh, thank you. So today let's talk about what's going on near Yellowstone with buffalo and then expand that into a discussion of the wild.
Okay, well, I think I need to provide some context, so I'm going to go really back in history to begin with. You know, the general thought or feeling is that there were tens of millions of bison on the Great Plains, particularly back at the time of the first fur trappers and other explorers were entering that region in the early 1800s. And there's a couple of important points that are relevant to that issue. Bison were found all the way back to the eastern part of the United States. Buffalo, New York is named because there were buffalo there. In Ohio, generally to the west of the Appalachian Mountains, Kentucky, etc., there were small isolated herds of bison. The thought on that is that they were able to, there was a major drought in the Great Plains in the, around 800 to 1300, 1400 AD. And actually the herds in the Great Plains shrank a lot, but they moved into other habitat further east, in part created by the fires during the drought that eliminated some of the tree cover and made more grasslands. Now anyway, there's an interesting thing there. At the same time, bison were not found much to the west of the Continental Divide. They would, you know, slip over somewhat into parts of Wyoming, Idaho, northern Utah, but places like California, Nevada, Oregon, etc., haven't had bison since the last ice age, and the bison that were living in those places at the time was a different species than occurs today. In any event, so
wait,
there
I
was
got
a great.
I got a question about that. So why would they not? Why would they not? I mean, California is pretty rich, and why would the buffalo not come? If they crossed the divide and went into Idaho, was it sort of the Great Basin Desert that prevented them from making their way to California?
Yes, partly, and there's all sorts of theories on the why there were limits on bison further west. One is that the grasslands that existed at the end of the ice age had very limited herbivory pressure, and so you had grasses that flourish that are not very resistant to grazing pressure, which is one of the reasons why cattle grazing in that region has such a negative impact. But also the theory is that the nutritional levels, the grasses in the Great Plains, and without getting into a whole lot of detail, are at their peak nutritional value in the summertime. And in the Great Basin, they're called cool season grasses, which grow mostly in the spring and go into dormancy by July usually. And so one theory is that the grasses that existed in the Great Basin didn't provide enough nutrition for the herds to do well, and that the animals would occasionally move over into the over the Continental Divide into these areas, you know, and just subsist as small herds here and there on the best habitat, but it wasn't sufficient to have, you know, massive herds like on the Great Plains.
Okay, thank you. So sorry to interrupt, go ahead.
Yeah, well anyway, so the other thing to keep in mind then is then that these herds would, you know, expand and shrink based on climate in part. And during the 1800s, when the first Europeans were, you know, crossing the Great Plains and exploring the you know, the upper reaches of rivers like the Missouri, et cetera, was actually during the Little Ice Age when things were moister in general in the Great Plains. So one theory, again, this is all looking back at history, we can't prove any of it, but that the bison actually reached a peak numbers around that time, and that is one thing that helped to sustain the Plains Indian bison culture, particularly once they got horses, so that they were able to, you know, chase these mobile herds. And the idea that the Great Plains was covered from one area, you know, from the north to south in one great herd, you know, it's kind of a fabrication. There's lots of historical references. For example, a guy named Captain Reynolds, who traveled across South Dakota, Reynolds Pass in Montana, between Idaho and Montana is named for him. He was guided by Jim Bridger, who you might know too, Bridger Teton National Forest, the Bridger Range in Montana. He was a fur trapper. Anyway, Reynolds crossed South Dakota and into Montana, and then spent the winter in Wyoming, and then traveled over around the Wind River Range through the past the Tetons into Henry's Lake, Idaho, then across his namesake pass, Reynolds Pass, to the headwaters of the Missouri River, traveled down the Missouri River to Fort Benton, which was a trading post at the time, and then continued on to North Dakota. Well, in that traverse, which was in 1858, he didn't even see a bison all the way across South Dakota. And he encountered his first bison herd on the Powder River in what is now Wyoming. And they were fairly frequently seen from there to the Yellowstone River and the Bighorn River, which he traveled up past the Bighorn Range. And then he spent the winter in Wyoming. And when he left in the spring, they traveled, as I said, to, you know, past the Tetons and to the headwaters of the Missouri and so forth. They didn't see any other bison except for one small herd right near the headwaters of the Madison River until they got below Fort Benton. The point of all that is to suggest that, you know, bison were highly mobile, and, you know, here's a military expedition traveling through a lot of what is considered the prime bison country and didn't see bison. And at other times people saw, you know, massive herds. So I think that's an important thing to know. In any event, due to both Indian hunting for subsistence and trade, there, a lot of bison were killed for buffalo robes that were traded at the trading post, combined with you know, increasing, particularly after the 1850s, 1860s and 70s, there was a lot of killing of bison for their hides, as well as eventually the skulls, you know, the heads and so forth as trophies and so forth. And so by the 1880s, bison were very scarce. In fact, by the late 1880s, they were thought to be almost extinct. And Hornaby, who has a first name I can't remember right now.
George, I think.
But he, yeah, well, he worked for the American Museum of Natural History or something like that, and decided to do an expedition to try to find, you know, some of the last bison. And ironically, he's very apologetic about killing them, but he felt like he had to. And he found some small, I mean, I'm talking like, you know, 10, 12 animals in groups, in Montana, north of Miles City. And these were thought to be some of the last bison left in the wild. And then, as a, you know, zone was not established until 1872. All these dates are very important. You have to keep the timeline, in place. And when Yellowstone was established, it was established primarily for the geological features like the geysers and so forth. But one consequence of it, of course, is that it did protect wildlife to a degree, although there was a lot of poaching going on. And one of the things that was found in Yellowstone in the 1870s and 1880s was wild bison. And in fact, some of our wildlife laws result from the poachers there. There was a thing, a law that was passed called the Lacey Act, which made it illegal to transport wildlife, you know, parts, et cetera, across state lines. And that was a direct consequence of the poachers who were killing bison in Yellowstone and then, you know, selling the parts and heads and so forth. And at the time that Yellowstone was first established, there was no Park Service or anything. And the continual poaching prompted the government to place the U.S. Army in charge of managing Yellowstone Park in the 1880s. So their military presence helped to slow the slaughter of bison in Yellowstone to the point where they believe there were about 25 wild bison left in Yellowstone by the 1890s. And there were a few other herds. There was one in Texas and one in Alberta, and there were some bison on the Flathead Indian Reservation in Montana. But the ones in Yellowstone were the only ones that were sort of continuously wild. And into that herd, they supplemented it with some of the bison from the Goodnight herd in Texas, and I believe some from the Flathead herd too, and tried to protect the bison so that the herds would grow. And initially, at first, they had hay fields out in the Lamar Valley. Everybody knows Lamar Valley today is a good place to look for wolves and so forth. But at one time, it was considered the buffalo ranch, and they raised hay to feed the bison that were there trying to bring up their numbers. And during these early efforts to promote bison in the park, the herds were very small, but they gradually increased, and now we have, I'm kind of fast-forwarding, approximately 4,000 to 4,500 bison in Yellowstone. And it is the largest continuously wild herd. And I use somewhat in quotes the idea wild because, as I said, they had supplemental feed for a little while, but not a very long time. And they were never selectively hunted or processed. In other words, they weren't, they didn't go in there and, you know, take out all the bison bulls and that kind of stuff. Although there was some, control, at one point in time back, I think in the 1930s. Inside the park, that is. And so today we have 4,500 bison. And the fast forward, in the 1980s, there became a concern about brucellosis. Now, brucellosis is a disease that can cause abortions of calves in domestic livestock, in cattle. It does not appear to cause abortion in bisons. Although one theory is under the stress of wild conditions, bison cows with a calf that is infected with brucellosis is reabsorbed before it can be large enough to be aborted. And so they don't have examples of calves being aborted because of brucellosis, as like in livestock. Nevertheless, the brucellosis causes disease in humans called onion fever. And it used to be very, very common that people would get this primarily from drinking dairy milk from dairy cows that had brucellosis. And in the 1930s, the U.S. government started a campaign to eliminate brucellosis from all domestic livestock. And the way it worked was if your cattle had documented brucellosis, they would just kill the herd and eliminate that herd from the area. So eventually, through that process, brucellosis was pretty much eliminated from most of the United States, although occasionally brucellosis gets into cattle down in Texas, sometimes from Mexican herds that are brought into the country, etc. But the point being is that being brucellosis-free confers benefits on the livestock producer. If you are a brucellosis-free state, you can sell your cattle any place in the United States. If you are known to have brucellosis within the state or a particular herd, then the government, the federal government, can put a quarantine on those cattle or that herd and make it more difficult to sell your livestock. So that's sort of the background behind why the livestock industry doesn't want brucellosis to infect its herds. But that and there is brucellosis in the bison in Yellowstone. It is believed that they got the brucellosis when there was a time when dairy cows were kept in Yellowstone to provide, you know, milk to tourists and so forth, and they think that the dairy cows transmitted it to the bison. But it's not only bison, but elk also carry brucellosis. And that's an important thing to understand, because so far, all the livestock herds that have have gotten brucellosis have gotten it from elk, not from bison. And this becomes important because elk are allowed to freely move outside of Yellowstone Park without restrictions on them, but bison in Yellowstone Park are either captured and slaughtered, or they're killed by hunters and tribal members at the border, and basically a bottleneck to keep the bison from wandering outside of Yellowstone Park. And the excuse given for this is brucellosis, even though there is no documented transfer of brucellosis from wild bison to domestic livestock. And a further complicating thing on this is that the livestock industry uses the excuse that the state might lose its brucellosis free status if a herd contracts the disease. And in fact, it hasn't lost its brucellosis free status. So it uses that as a scare tactic, because they can just quarantine a specific herd. They don't have to give the whole state a black eye, so to speak. But because of that, the Montana legislature has prohibited basically bison from moving out of Yellowstone Park, except for a very small area adjacent to the park, and also has made it very difficult to transplant bison, because one, of course, solution to bison coming out of Yellowstone Park is to capture them rather than kill them, but start new herds in other parts of the West. So the Charles M. Russell Wildlife Refuge on the Missouri River and the Missouri River National Monument makes up an area of well over 1 million acres where bison, of course, were historically found and could be restored. But because of the legislature's opposition to the transfer of bison, any bison, so far that hasn't happened. So what we have is bison, about 10,000 bison so far, I believe, have been killed at the boundary of Yellowstone Park. And this has consequences beyond just the fact that we don't get to have wild bison herds established around the West in suitable habitat. It also means that there's a artificial selection going on for the genetics of this herd, which is the most unique wild herd, tracing its ancestry back to the original wild bison, and has been, for the most part, been managed as a wild herd. In other words, with no culling inside the park, with the ability of the animals, you know, the sex ratio of the animals being more or less natural. You know, in an artificial situation, they usually get rid of bison bulls, and just like with cows, so you have, cattle, I mean, so you understand when I say cows, cattle, domestic cattle, they eliminate the bulls and mostly want to have the females so that they can produce more calves. So you get an unusual sex ratio. Whereas in wild herds, like in Yellowstone, you have nearly as many bulls as you have females, and those bulls compete among themselves to be the ones that get to do the breeding. And so a lot of the breeding is done by a very small percentage of the bison bulls. And this has two consequences. One, of course, is theoretically the bulls that are the best fitness are the ones that are doing the majority of the breeding. The other is that breeding by what are called tournament animals. This pertains to elk or any other species where a single male does a lot of the breeding in a herd. That means your genetic diversity is much less. So when you start culling the bison as they're doing, and they call it harvesting, they call it killing, when they kill bison out, as they wander out of the park, they're disrupting that sort of natural evolutionary process. And another evolutionary process as a result is bison have become increasingly important in Yellowstone for predators. So for the wolves, the grizzly bears, and smaller animals that feed on, you know, scavenging coyotes, ravens, magpies, etc. When a bison dies, and many of them do in the wintertime from the winter stress, and say a grizzly comes out of hibernation in the spring and finds a dead bison, that's like winning the lottery. Because there isn't much to eat in March or April, and a dead bison carcass is a really big deal. Well, if you're culling the herds as soon as they reach the border of the park, you're reducing the population, which reduces the stresses on the herds themselves, which means you have fewer dead animals dying inside the park from starvation, from other factors. Even when they're alive, if they're weakened because of competition, they're more vulnerable to wolves and grizzly bears and so forth. So it indirectly, the current program of capturing and killing or just shooting them on the border of the park has ecological consequences for the entire ecosystem, Yellowstone ecosystem, and for all the other predators and scavengers that rely on those bison. So right now we're at a standstill. There was actually on Christmas Day yesterday, there was a lawsuit that got a positive decision. The Cottonwood Law Clinic in Bozeman, Montana, successfully overturned an earlier decision and requires that the Park Service and the state of Montana and so forth come up with a review of their management plan. And of course, they're arguing that they're just arbitrarily killing bison. So whether that'll do anything in the long run, I don't know, but it's a positive a decision, in fact, that may eventually lead to having more bison on public lands. And bison, by the way, the reason why the ranchers use the excuse of brucellosis, because the real reason, in my view, and I've gotten this from other sources, that there's opposition to having bison on public lands outside of Yellowstone Park. And mind you, Yellowstone has no domestic livestock grazing permitted. But on national forest lands surrounding Yellowstone, as well as BLM lands, Bureau of Land Management lands, and the Charles M. Russell Wildlife Refuge, so-called wildlife refuge, it has cattle grazing on it. So the ranchers in the livestock industry is afraid that if bison are allowed to sort of repopulate these areas or be transplanted and new herds started, there will be competition for forage. And they are afraid that if push comes to shove, that the public will prefer to see bison on the public lands than cattle. In other words, if there's only so much forage to go around and you have 1,000 cows permitted to graze there and you have 500 bison grazing there, well, that 500 bison is like having an extra 500 cattle grazing there. So at some level, you're going to have to reduce either the bison or you're going to have to reduce the cattle, and they're afraid that the cattle will be the ones that will be reduced. So that is what I think is driving the management in the state of Montana and the legislature, which has so far said that any bison in the state, like for example the American Prairie Foundation that's trying to buy up private land along the Missouri River and create a giant I might call it a park, they're envisioning 3 to 4 million acres eventually, they have bison on some of their lands, but they have to be managed and considered by the state as livestock. and they're not allowed to, for example, establish new herds with those bison. And there's another controversy that is related to that with the American Prairie Reserve, and that is that they, as they acquire these ranches that they've been buying from willing sellers, by the way, they often get grazing allotments associated with the ranch. And as is sort of standard practice, if somebody buys a ranch with a public lands grazing allotment, the grazing allotment is usually transferred to the new owner. In the case of the American Prairie Reserve, they are trying to get the laws changed so that they can graze bison on those BLM public lands allotments. And so far, as far as I know, I don't think they've succeeded with that. So that's our status and sort of historical context for the issue that's ongoing. Do you want to ask a question? I'm throwing in the direction or something.
No, that's a great overview. And one small thing, it was really bugging me.
Yeah.
It's William Hornaday.
It's
William, not George. I said it was George and I was wrong.
William, yep. Go ahead.
One sort of side comment that just, I mean, of course people would rather, except for cattle ranchers, of course people would rather see wild animals on public lands than cattle on public lands. I mean, it's just...
That's right, yeah. And you know, bison are one of the favorite things that people, beyond wolves, that people go to Yellowstone to see, wild, free-roaming bison. You know, almost all the other herds in the country are like, well, for example, the bison range, which is... Up north of Missoula, you know, they're fenced in there. They are culled like livestock, and they're sort of like semi-wild herds, but they're not fully wild. And there's some wild bison up in Alaska that were transplanted there, actually, that roam up and down the Chittenden River and Wrangell St. Elias National Park and on the Delta River south of Fairbanks. But you know, for the most part, there's also a herd in the Henry Mountains that's in Utah that I, as if I recall, was originated from bison from Yellowstone. But most, you know, like the Badlands National Park and Theodore Roosevelt National Park and some of these other places where we do have bison herds, they're pretty heavily managed because they're on small, basically islands of habitat. But there's no reason why. Especially in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, bison, there's a lot of habitat just in surrounding national forests and wilderness areas that could be colonized if the bison weren't killed as soon as they moved out of the park. And then, as I said, we could establish new herds. Charles M. Russell is a good one, but there's also the Red Desert area of Wyoming, which is largely BLM land and with historic habitat for bison herds. Some of the parks like North Park in Colorado also had bison historically. So there's places where there's still fairly large areas, mostly public land, that we could reestablish, fairly significant herds of wild bison if they were permitted. And some of the tribes, by the way, are trying to establish herds on their reservations, but so far most of them are pretty small. And they have opposition too, from ranchers in surrounding areas. So the whole thing is that the livestock industry at this point is controlling the discussion, and it just is another example where the small minority and relatively unimportant economic interest gets to control public policy on public wildlife.
So before we talk about the difference between wild and semi-wild, you use that phrase. Mm-hmm. There's one other point I want to hit, which is when you said that the buffalo who don't, if you shoot buffalo and take them away, those buffalo that makes it so there's less food for predators. And this is a phrase that I first heard by John Livingston that has stuck with me ever since that I think people really need to understand, and they don't, is he said there is no surplus in nature. And what he meant by that was that everybody is food for somebody. And we are so stupid in this culture that it's like a big cargo cult, that we don't understand that if you take a buffalo out of the Yellowstone larger, the Yellowstone biome, then you have taken 2,000 pounds of meat and guts and bone away from somebody else who would have eaten it. And it's the same no matter what you eat, that if you take land to grow lettuce, that's land somebody else can't use. And if you eat a tuna, that's a tuna that whoever eats tuna, I don't know, sharks or somebody, that's food they can't eat. And if you, we don't understand that everybody eats, everybody gets eaten in the end. And so if you take away, 2,000 pounds from Yellowstone, that's 2,000 pounds you've taken away from Yellowstone.
Exactly. And it's a very, that's a very important concept for people to understand, is that, you know, some years they've killed over 1,000 bison. That's a lot of animals. That's a lot of meat, as you suggest.
That's 2 million pounds.
Some of that. Yeah. And not all of those animals. Yeah. Not all those animals would have died necessarily or been killed by predators, but, you know, pretty easy to argue at least some of them would have. And so you're taking food right out of the mouth of grizzlies and wolves and coyotes and red fox and magpies and maybe even wolverine, etc.
I wanted to highlight that before we move on. So now, can you talk about, you said wild and semi-wild, and I know when I've talked to Buffalo Field Campaign people, they've talked about the genetic pureness. And then there's one more thing I want to say before I'll just shut up and let you go, which is that I'm generally in anything to preserve wild species, which includes captive breeding programs. But having said that, I also remember when I was writing my book Against Zoos that even after only like two or three generations of having been raised in a zoo, a lot of species already are having differences. You're already changing the species itself. So can you talk about wild and the effects of management? You've talked about management a bunch of times. Can you talk about what wild means in this context and answer the question better than I'm asking it?
I'll try. Yes. Well, again, getting back to the history, when I said there was 25 or so wild bison, so that's a genetic bottleneck in the terms of, you know, biology. In other words, like a bottle that gets narrow near the top, when you have that few of animals, you have greatly already reduced the genetic diversity in the species. And then that is compounded, as I said, by the fact that there's tournament breeders, so that you have, you know, one bull, you know, responsible for a lot of the genetics that are found in that herd, because unlike where you have species where they're more monogamous, the one bull might breed, you know, 20 cows or something, that is bison cows, and therefore you know, his contribution to the genetics is much smaller than if they were monogamous. So and the selective factors in Yellowstone of harsh winters, of predators, limited forage availability because of snow covering the grasses that they feed on primarily in the wintertime, all those things have been operating more or less in Yellowstone since the bison were first protected there. And it's a natural tendency that the reason bison are moving out of the park is as their numbers have grown, there's only a limited amount of winter range, that's the snow-free or places where the forage is not too deeply covered by snow, available to the bison. So some of them start to move, and they tend to move to lower elevations that are less with less snow. And that migration tendency is something that is passed on from usually the female bison are the leaders of these migration herds, that knowledge of where to go in harsh winters is passed on. Well, if you're culling or killing the bison, I'm going to use the word killing, killing the bison as soon as they wander out of the park, you're taking away from that herd the cultural knowledge, which is transferred from individual to individual. So you have a loss of genetic diversity and a loss of cultural diversity. You know, and the funny thing is that, of course, in our society right now, we're all the time talking about how, the, you know, we need to recognize cultural diversity. And yet we haven't applied that idea to wildlife. And a lot of wildlife, you know, is it, the animals have learned behavior, or, you know, grizzly bear learns what is food from its mother. The elk and the bison learn where they move at certain times of year to, you know, avoid either predators or find food. And that knowledge gets transferred from individual to individual in a herd. And when we kill them, we are killing that cultural knowledge and that genetic diversity. And in the managed herds, you know, they never even get a chance. This is the semi-wild herds that I'm in. They never get a chance to even develop that cultural knowledge or reestablish it. And they never, because of the killing of the bison to maintain the smaller numbers, their overall population is small. And there are people who feel that you have to have between 5,000 and 10,000 bison in a herd to really, you know, maintain the genetic diversity over the long point. To get back to the idea that you mentioned about zoos, they found the same thing in hatcheries with fish, where within 2 to 3 generations of being raised in a hatchery, fish lose certain genetic traits that help them adapt to the wild. An example I can give from a species I'm familiar with is Arctic grayling in Montana. Have some genetic diversity, and one of the you know, they're becoming very rare. I'm trying to get them listed under the Endangered Species Act, but one of the traits is holding in the current. It turns out that there's genetic differences in grayling about holding in the current. Some grayling, particularly ones from hatcheries, have lost that trait of holding in current. So if you take fish from a hatchery, grayling, and you're trying to repopulate a river with them, they just go downstream and disappear. Whereas the native fish that are wild and have grew up on that river have are genetically inclined to stay in the current and hold their place so that they don't migrate downstream and disappear. So anyway, that's just a little example. And those changes happen very rapidly, as you suggested, 2, 3, 4 generations. So that's why Yellowstone's herds are so valuable, because despite a little bit of, you know, help they got with supplemental feed, et cetera, in the early part of their history there, they have, for the most part, compared to any other herds we have anyway, been the ones where natural evolutionary processes have been allowed to act upon them. And they are probably the best adapted to any kind of changes that are going to happen due to climate change, for example. They have the widest diversity in their genes and are the ones that are going to be best able to deal with changing climate, which will affect, of course, the vegetation and other things that will be of concern to them.
This is a little bit off topic, but one of the reasons I love talking with you is that you have such a broad breadth of knowledge that I can just throw out these random questions and I can get my curiosity satisfied. So passenger pigeons, of course they were hunted to extinction, but one of the problems was that they were so used to being in these huge, huge flocks that if you broke off into a smaller flock, that did not fit with their optimal survival strategy. And so a small flock could be picked off much more easily by regular predators as well as humans. And so I'm wondering, when you talk about buffalo culture, I wonder, you know, I think about prairie dog villages that some of them are small, but there were some that went over thousands and thousands and thousands of acres, and maybe 100,000 acres down in Texas. And what about buffalo? Do you think that the culture, has there been something happen with no longer being massive herds as well as small herds? Do you think that that has had a cultural effect on them? I'm just throwing this random thought out.
Yeah. Well, I can give you one example, which is an interesting, it sort of gets to what you're talking about, I think. There was a bison skull found in Mount Hare Lake in Oregon, which is far west of where bison were thought to, be found. The skull, they think, was from back toward, more towards the Ice Age, tail end of the Ice Age. But nevertheless, but one of the things that was interesting about it was it had, deformed in many ways. And they think that was due to genetic inbreeding. In other words, the implied message was that there was a small herd of bison in that part of Oregon, but they were so small that they suffered from inbreeding problems. And that may, in fact, have been the reason why they disappeared more than anything. But small populations are more likely to suffer from genetic effects. That is one of the reasons why most population ecologists suggest that we need larger herds and larger populations of animals. Using Yellowstone grizzly as another example, there's an attempt, as you're aware, to delist the Protection of the Endangered Species Act on the Yellowstone grizzly because they suggest there's 700 or so bears in the ecosystem. And whether there are 700 or not, a lot of ecologists will tell you that they need about 5,000. So, have a good chance of being genetically diverse enough to sustain themselves over the long haul. And that's true for so many of our populations, prairie dogs, which you mentioned. Most of them are not in large enough populations to sustain them over the long haul. And I think, these are all like ticking time bombs because, we don't know what genes are in these different animals that will have adaptive value in the future. A lot of times the genes are not expressed until they need to be expressed. So, there may be, for example, genetic genes in, I'll just say something that you're familiar with, coast redwoods. If the climate got really dry, there would probably be some redwoods that have a gene that's better adapted to drought. We don't know which trees have that. They may not even be expressing it at this point. But the greater the genetic diversity, the better the chance that they'll have such an adaptation. So usually what happens in a lot of populations that your question gets at this point is we tend to get a lot of small fragmented populations that have limited genetic exchange with other ones, and they tend to wink out over time. And in the example I talked about earlier about how Reynolds went across the Great Plains, and I could give you many other examples like this, where he didn't see bison for a long time, then he found some pretty large herds. Those herds were moving around all the time and growing and shrinking and intermixing, and with no fences and with no other obstacles to doing that, they periodically exchange their genetic materials when they got together in larger herds, and even if there was a small herd, the chances were good that over time at some point another herd might move into that area and provide genetic exchanges. So we have bottlenecked all sorts of wildlife with highways, with our developments, with the farms, etc., that have fragmented habitat so that the movement of species and therefore the movement of genetic material is greatly limited. And we have many more populations in small groups that are vulnerable to what is termed stochastic events, like a drought or maybe a fire or any other kind of some disease that comes in to the population. And a larger population would be able to survive it, but the smaller ones, just all the animals die out and there's nothing nearby to replace them, and then the overall range of that animal or plant shrinks.
So we only have a couple minutes left, and Is there anything you want to say to, I mean, is there anything else you want to say about this particular subject?
Well, you know, there's right now, the one of the things that I don't agree with is the participation of hunters, whether it's tribal members and or white hunters, killing bison at the edge of Yellowstone Park. They're sort of like self-defeating their own goals, which, you know, if there were more wild herds, there'd be more places to go hunting. And indirectly, they're doing the dirty work of the ranchers. In other words, the ranchers want to see those animals killed. If you didn't have the hunting, then they'd have to do it themselves. And I think that would be politically more outrageous to people. And, you know, because there's a general feeling, well, if you're using the meat, you know, okay, it's all right to kill these bison, you know, for food. However, if that hunting wasn't occurring outside of the park, the ranchers would still probably want to see some slaughters happening because they want to keep the bison bottled up. And so it's disheartening to me to see hunters participating in the kill every year, because indirectly they are helping the livestock industry with its goals of keeping bison from really being wild animals and being restored to much of their range.
Okay, I'm not going to ask you to agree with this, but mm-hmm. I've always thought that if these hunters want to go get something off of public lands, they should go shoot some cows.
Well, you know, that was Ed Abbey's thing. Although, if you recall, there's a part in one of his books where he says, well, we ought to be doing hunting cattle, but he also said there wouldn't be much sport, you know, because they're not too smart. And that actually... to get to that actually hits on something with the bison at Yellowstone. They're used to seeing people all the time, and for unfortunately they don't try to escape the hunters, you know. And so it's kind of like, you know, shooting fish in a bowl, as they say. It's very it takes advantage of their lack of caution. And, you know, modern weapons and spotting scopes and pickup trucks and ATVs and drones and all that stuff is used by the hunters to locate the animals and get them, you know, to herd them towards roads and stuff to kill them. You know, so the whole thing is sort of a real, in my view, a disgrace in both in how it affects the politics as well as just how the hunts are implemented. And I'm not totally against hunting wild bison, but I want them to be wild. I want them to be widespread. And then we can talk about whether it's reasonable to have a hunting season. But right now, I think, the hunting, is counterproductive.
Well, and also open the hunting season, open some hunting seasons when wild bison, not managed herds, when wild bison populations reach, I don't know, 10 million?
Yeah, I don't know if we'll ever see that again, but certainly a lot more than we have now. Sure, that's what I would say. There's a lot of opportunity. If anybody says there's, quote, surplus bison, I would counter that and say, no, we don't have a surplus of bison. We don't have any bison that we can afford to give up, especially the bison from Yellowstone, which are some of the most genetically unique bison herds we have. And so they have high conservation value, that we're killing these animals that have such high conservation value, I think is a great public tragedy.
Well, thank you so much for saying all that. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been George Werthner. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.